Good morning.
Good morning.
A lovely reception. Being blessed like that. Thank you. If you are towards the back and can't see me, feel free to move your chair around for a line, sight line, if you care to see me while you hear me. Do that. What I'm going to do this morning is I'm going to speak for a main presentation of a little less than an hour on an in-depth introduction to contemplative prayer in the Christian mystical tradition and gravitate our reflections toward the Christian mystical a tradition of non-dual consciousness. That's, of course, the heart of Richard's book, The Naked Now. Then, at the end of that mental reflection, we'll stand for a few seconds to stretch and open it up for dialogue. Say, up to 15 minutes of dialogue. And then we'll take a break. We'll come back from the break. We'll have a very short sitting, just a few minutes of shared meditation. And then we'll address several other questions in non-dual consciousness and emergence teachings and so on. So how's that sound in the afternoon? It'll be a morning in non-dual contemplative consciousness. So the Christian mystical tradition, prayer and meditation in the Christian mystical tradition, and gravitating towards insights into the Christian mystical understanding of non-dual consciousness. Starting from scratch, like from the very beginning. So we all feel comfortable starting out together. You know, first of all, I guess we could say that the Christian mystical tradition assumes several things. And by that I mean these classical texts in the mystics. John of the Cross, Feast of Avalon, Plot of Unknowing, Meister Eckhart, Julian of Norwich, the Desert Tradition, Blessed John Roysbrook, and so on, these classical mystical teachings. They assume several things. First, they assume a daily life that you're living your life. Secondly, they assume a life of goodwill, that you're trying to be a down-to-earth, real human being, a mensch, and that you're trying to live by love. That all things considered, what's the most loving thing I can do for myself right now? For this person right now? This community right now? This living being right now? In this situation? All things considered, what's the most loving thing to do? And doing one's best to do. Next. It assumes that this life, this daily life of love, is illumined by faith. It's illumined by faith. That is, that God is the origin, ground, and fulfillment of our lives. God is the infinite love that creates us, the infinite love that sustains us, the infinite love that calls us to itself. And in the Christian tradition, this love is revealed to us in Jesus. And so we're disciples of Jesus as loving men and women, and lives illumined by faith, and bearing witness to this faith illumined life through love. As you shall know my disciples, that you love one another, even as I have loved you. They're assuming this. Next. They're assuming that in this life, there is a kind of a daily quiet time to experientially ground ourselves in the life that we're living. Imagine a married couple who love each other, do many things for each other, but they're never with each other because they're very busy. They're very, very busy. They're just too busy to be with each other. This would be a problem. So we can be very busy doing things for God. We can be very sincere about living the way God wants us to live, but never stop to be with God. And so God's going, you know, like, what am I, chopped liver here? What's wrong? Like, why all the avoidance? Why all the intimacy avoidance? And so there's a daily quiet time, like, here I am, Lord. Here I am, Lord, just as I am. To sink the taproot of our heart in a sincere openness to God. To be nourished by God, illumined by God, encouraged by God, led by God, inspired by God, renewed by God. To then get up from that daily prayer to go out and then live that life. Come back the next day, you get re-grounded again, renew the intimacy, the groundness, you go out and you live this way. And this rhythm of interior groundedness, live day by day, interior groundedness, live day by day, is the life. It is the life. And in terms of the prayer, then what's the tradition of prayer in this sense? Like when in the Christian tradition, you're here for your daily quiet time, you're sitting there for your daily prayer time. What goes on during that prayer time? How does the what's the person do there? And here is kind of a basic sense of prayer is a time to build psychological, spiritual foundations, or to build foundations of psychological, spiritual maturity in our life. And in my book, the Christian Meditation, this is the chapter, The Ladder to Heaven. The Ladder to Heaven. Which is the which is a reflection on the book by Guigo the Carthusian. Guigo the Carthusian, and it's in each double day. It's called The Ladder of Monks. The Ladder of Monks. This is 12th century medieval hermit, Carthusian hermit, Christian hermit, who wrote this little classic, The Ladder of Monks. And really, it became a very influential book in terms of kind of stating this basic tradition. It was well in place before Guido, but Guido kind of synthesizes it in a very specific, simple way. And here's what Guido says. These are the guidelines for the quiet time with God. And this is the prayer for sincere beginners. Thomas Merton once said, let's face it, we'll be beginners all our lives. And you'll die a beginner. Hopefully a seasoned beginner. But you will die a beginner. And so Guigo puts it this way. He says it moves in this quiet time. It moves in a great evolution of consciousness from Lectio Divina, spiritual reading, to meditation, here meaning discursive meditation, using thoughts and images. Lectio Divina, discursive meditation, prayer, the contemplation. So I'd like to walk through these. And I'd like to use a text as an example. You go to your daily quiet time. You sit quietly. Like, here I am, Lord. Here I am, Lord. The daily rendezvous. You open the scriptures. And you read a text. And here's the text. Here's the text of there's a text in the New Testament, John, says that if our heart condemns us, God is greater than our heart. So that's a great text. If our heart condemns us, God is greater than our heart. Lectio Divina is sustained receptivity to a beauty not yet thought about. In other words, you haven't yet begun to reflect on the text. that no sooner did you read it than there's an immediate recognition of the beauty of what's there. It, something in the pit of the stomach is drawn to it. It rings true. It rings true. That if our heart condemns us, God is greater than our hearts. And one might then read several passages, we might read a whole chapter of scripture, or any book that takes us to the deeper place. More like listening to music. It's more like experiential humility, of being sustained receptivity to a beauty, or a truth, or a depth, or a presence, or a resonance, not yet thought. T.S. Eliot says in Fourth Quartet, he says, to hope too soon is to hope for the wrong thing. Mm-hmm. And sometimes we think too soon. We're already so leaping with our opinion, but we haven't listened yet. In psychotherapy, it often fascinates me how the heart of psychotherapy, someone will come in and they'll start on why they're there. And after a few minutes, I say to them, well, you know, first of all, I'm sorry you're having to go through all this. Really, I can tell this is difficult for you. I'd like to ask a few questions to help me understand better. Why don't we check our pagers and cell phones and see that they're in contemplative mode? So we could do that. Mine's not, but I will not watch me get paged. I'm not rummaging through my bag here. If we could do that, would be good. I say to you, you come in, you start out with your story on why you're there. And I say to you, I'm sorry you're going through this. I'd like to ask you a few questions that help me understand better what you're saying. And the questions I ask are questions you can't answer unless you listen more deeply to yourself. You go, well, I and you answer. And I listen, I said, I think I understand. I'd like to ask another question, help me understand more. And laying it bare, laying it bare, laying it bare, half hour later, you're listening to yourself at a very vulnerable level. And a lot of times we're always on the run. You know, I mean, we're always caught up in the entanglements of our answers without having quietly listened to ourselves. So Lectio Divina is being schooled in the experiential humility of sustained receptivity, listening to our breathing, listening to what's going on, the Lectio, to receive it. Next. If our hearts condemn us, God is greater than our hearts. Lectio Divina leads to meditatio. And here in the Christian tradition, when the Christian mystics use meditation, they almost always mean discursive meditation using thoughts and images. You allow the text to initiate an inner dialogue between you and God on how the truth of that text is operative in your life today. So it would go like this. If my heart condemns me, God is greater than my heart. Well, I'm certainly no stranger to my heart condemning me. There are certain things that I did that hurt people, have hurt myself. There are certain things I failed to do that have hurt me and have hurt others. And if there would be some way I could go back and undo that, I would, and I can't. And there's like a punitive voice inside of me that condemns me. Therefore, if I have the final say in where I stand with you, I'm in serious trouble. Because I'm pretty harsh. There's a voice inside of me that will not lighten up. And it bears down on me with a shaming message. And there's a childlike part of me that believes and feels trapped. But you are greater than my heart. You are greater than my heart. You're infinitely greater than my heart. And I ask for the grace to put my faith in your love for me as precious in my brokenness, more than my faith in my brokenness, that I not buy into the ideology of my brokenness, but rather I invest myself in your infinite oceanic love for me, loving me through and through and through and through in the intimate details of my brokenness. This sincere dialogue with God is the mind being infused with grace. That is, this is the mind turning towards the beauty interiorly received. So that beauty can infuse itself into our thoughts, into our reflections, into the way we see ourselves. Meditatio. This meditatio, this meditation, leads to prayer. And prayer is the effectus of the heart. It's the heart response. The heart response. If it was just meditation, it would all be intuition. So it would all be insight, intuition. The prayer is desire. It's desire. You're moved by it. Lord God, please help me to trust in your mercy for it me as precious and marvelous. Help me. Help me here. Please. And I ask for the grace of experiencing your love for me in my prayers. The sincere hearted desire is the prayer. If you're moved by the prayer. And this prayer, this is how it works. Every day you come. This is very, there's nothing fancy here. Salt of the earth, a nitty gritty, ordinary, living sincerity. Now you open the scriptures, you quietly sit, you read the text. Receptive beauty to not yet, receptive openness to beauty not yet thought about. You engage in a sincere dialogue. You might journal, write out your insights, your thoughts, underline the text, engage in this. The prayer helped me today to do this. And you go out and live your life. You come back the next day, you open the scriptures, and you do that very safely every day for 88 years. And just one day you just tip over and go home. This is the life of holiness. This is how this works. This is holiness. There's nothing more than this. This is the efficacy of God in the sincerity of our hearts. Does that make sense so far?
Yes.
Yeah, that's it. Now, contemplation. Liga the Carthusian says, you're sitting there like this in this loving exchange with God. And you feel within your heart a kind of an ache. For a longing for a yet deeper union, for the actual experience of the beloved. See, not thoughts about the beloved, not the desire to do the will of the beloved, but you want to taste the essence of the beloved. That desire for union with God. See, the living intimacy of God's heart is contemplation. It's an ache in your heart for union. Now, our faith teaches us that at the moment of biological death, we are not annihilated, but through all eternity, this infinite union is our destiny. God will be all in all forever. And so you say to God, I know this is going to be really wonderful when this happens, but I don't want to wait till I die to experience it. How about a little love here? I'd like to experience it now. That desire to know God the way the blessed know God in paradise. See, that desire to know God as God knows. That's the beginning of the contemplation. Contemplation is a quiet inner inclination to wordlessly rest in the infinite depths of God. Now, this desire cannot be consummated because your finite will is not capable of an infinite union. You see that? Because the will is finite, And because the union is infinite, the finite will cannot be the means of reaching the infinite union, because the finite is not the means of the infinite. Therefore, you take the profound powerlessness within your heart to consummate the union. This is really, I think, at the heart of our situation as human beings. That we are powerless to realize that without which life remains forever incomplete. This is our dilemma. We are powerless to realize that without which life remains forever incomplete. And to avoid that poverty of heart, some people don't let themselves feel that desire. They'll say, I'll stay on this side of the fence with what I can manage. I'll eat brownies and watch television. I'll get in fights with people. I'll read books and express my opinion. I can deal with this. That the infinite love that is the architect of our hearts has made our hearts in such a way that nothing less than an infinite union will do. That's the setup. The infinite love that is the architect of our hearts has made our hearts in such a way that nothing less than an infinite union but the infinite will do. And so Guigo says, you cry out to God in this silent poverty. And he says, in this cry, like this longing, the love you are powerless to consummate cuts you off mid-sentence and gives itself to you in your powerlessness to realize it. Isn't that great? You're going along, I can't do it, I can't do it, I can't do it. It heightens, you lean into it. And then right mid-sentence, crying out to God, and this is a subtle ache in your heart. Thomas Merton once said to me in Direction, he said, once in a while, you'll find somebody encouraging you to be radically faithful to this desire. He said, but such people are hard to find. There's a lot of people who give you hundreds of reasons why you don't need to. There's a lot of people who don't even know anything about it. But to be radically faithful to what you are powerless to attain, and in that powerlessness, experience that which you are powerless to attain, granting itself to you, inexpressibly, contemplation. Now, this sweet taste, like resting in God, resting in you, it's childlike, it's wordless. It may be psychologically intense. It might be extremely subtle. It's like an intimately realized, unexpected oneness. And then it fades, like dissipates. You come back, and you pick up with your verse again. Your scriptures are still open on your lap, your finger is still on the tear-stained text. Hands trembling, oh my God. Deep water here. And whoa, horrible stuff. And what do you do? What do? You start to read the text again. But now everything is different. Because now you're lexio. You know at any given second it can all break open again. You engage in the reflection again, the meditatio. But now it's different. Because at any given second you can be caught mid-sentence with the taste of union. It gives rise to longing again that you cannot fulfill, but now it's different because you know at any given second the love you cannot attain might grant itself to you. Full bore. When will be the next time you get the big full taste? Don't know. Not your business. Not your business. You have to let unconsummated desire do its work in your heart. And then just when you're least expecting it again, there it is again. It's like this. Notice that the poet cannot make the poem happen. The poet cannot force the poem out onto the paper. The poet can assume the inner stance that offers the least resistance to the gift of poetry occurring. Does that make sense in a way? The artist cannot make beauty happen. Cannot force it out there. That's crafts. You can replicate it, just do it all you want. Paint by number and And there you go. Okay, Mark. We can speckle on art. But the gift of art, you cannot make it happen. But the artist assumes the inner stance of offers. Lovers cannot make the moments of oceanic union happen, but they can assume the inner stance that offers the least resistance to the renewed awareness of what is happening. And this is the contemplative. Now, are we together so far? Good. Now, this contemplation, the Christian tradition, we go up this ladder like this contemplatio, contemplation, has two aspects to it. There's a passive aspect, which is sometimes called mystical contemplation. And it's called passive because it happens to you. It's received as a gift, as we've been saying. There's also active contemplation, which are methods or strategies of sustaining the stance that offers the least resistance to mystical contemplation. There's a certain like art form of sustained vulnerability to the oneness one cannot attain. And any poet, lovers, the seasoned artists, the mystics, they know that art. You kind of find your way to that sustained vulnerability and you stay there. Utterly sincere, guileless, no ulterior motive. You just give yourself to it. Now, acts of contemplation are then methods of contemplative prayer. Methods of contemplative prayer. Now, because when the Buddhists speak of meditation, like Buddhist meditation, yoga meditation, they do not mean discursive meditation using thought and images. They mean contemplation. Buddhist meditation is contemplation, both in its active aspects of zazen, sitting practice, and in the passive aspects of enlightenment, like receiving the gift you cannot attain. Likewise with yoga, doing the postures, the breathing, the asanas, all these are modalities of active contemplation to receive the gift of this I am, thou art that. You realize this oneness. So when the Hindu meditation, yoga meditation, Buddhist meditation, they mean what the Christian mystics mean by contemplation. Is that clear? But because of the influence, growing influence of Hindu, yoga, Buddhism, and so on, a lot of Christians, they will speak of Christian meditation. But it's important to make this distinction that I'm making here. It should be clarified what we're talking about. Do we mean meditation as in discursive meditation, thoughts or images, which build these inner foundations to receive this contemplative gift? Or do we mean it Christian meditation, meaning Christian contemplation? Both methods of contemplative prayer and then the receiving from God of this oneness. Okay?
Could you go over that just one more time?
Yes. Yes, let me go over it again. When the Buddhists speak of Buddhist meditation, you know, to meditate, to practice Buddhist meditation, or the yogis speak of yoga meditation, in the light of this talk I just gave, they don't mean discursive meditation. When Buddhists meditate, they don't open up the sutras and engage in the dialogue. And they do that in Dharma talk, that discursive process has its role. But when you're sitting there in Zazen, when you're sitting there in your practice, you're not sitting there reflecting on anything. You're silently poised in attentiveness. You're in an active contemplation. That is, you're actively doing everything you can do to offer the least resistance to the awakening, to the enlightenment, the passive, the receptivity. There's a Zen story. You may have heard it when you hear this a lot. There's this monk who's trying very, very hard to be enlightened. And the Zen master sees how hard he's trying to be enlightened, like leaning into it, getting a spiritual hernia. Is it a mystical union or bust? You know, by God, I want to do this. Which is hubris. You know, I mean, it's hubris, really. It's sincere, but it's not tempered by humility. It's really not tempered by just. So the Zen master says, come to my room tonight at 5 or whatever it is. So when he gets there, the master's sitting there and he's rubbing two bricks together. And the student says, what are you doing? He says, I'm polishing these bricks to make mirrors. Yes, I'm going to shine them up to make mirrors. And the student laughs. He says, well, you'll never make mirrors by rubbing bricks together. He says, neither will you be enlightened by trying so hard. And the story says at which point the student was enlightened. Isn't that great? What you see, you can't do it. What you couldn't do happens. Sometimes real life like that. So when the Buddhists and Christians refer to meditation, they mean what in the Christian literature is meant by contemplation in this passive and active aspect. We together so far? Okay. Now I want to back up a little bit. Let's say you're actually living this way. I want to go back to Google for a minute, and I want to now look at some mystical texts on non-dual consciousness. You're going along just your ordinary self. Well, could you be? And with sincerity, you have your quiet time with God. And the scriptures are there, with your Thomas River, as you're saying your journals and your Bible, and the light your little candle, and you sit there and you're having your prayer. Here I am, Lord. You read the text with heartfelt sincerity. You engage in this loving exchange with God, your meditatio, this reflection. You journal out your insights that you got. Then it's the desire, help me to be faithful to this today. And when I stand up, help me not to break the thread of this awareness as I go through my day. And from time to time, when you sit like that, you feel a certain longing for a deeper union. It's very subtle. It's hard, and you kind of rest in it, you sense that like that, and there's certain moments where you taste a kind of oneness. And you go back to your text, you go live your life, the next day you come back and you live this way. This is what they're all talking about, really. And now, the Christian mystics say, as you live this way, and this is everything, because this is holiness. This is holiness. There is the charism of contemplative prayer. That is, God draws some people to a deeper, more sustained state of contemplative consciousness. It doesn't mean you're holier. Teresa of Avila says, when she's writing The Interior Castle, she says this. She says, these things I'm about to talk about, I'm writing them to help people who are experiencing these things. You can kind of understand what's happening to you. But she says, I want to stress that these things do not consist in holiness. She says, there are some people who have never experienced these things, and they're holier than the people who have a lot of them. And you might say to me, well, if this is true, why are you going to write a whole book about it? And she said, good question. Why don't you go ask the superior who told me I had to? Because they told her under obedience she had to write this book. And we're all glad that they made her do it. When I was in Avila, I saw the handwritten manuscript for the Interior Castle. She wrote it out, first draft, longhand. Pretty amazing. And so now we think the mystical text. Thomas Merton says, John of the Cross is writing for beginners. And by the way, he is. At the Ascent of Mount Carmel and the Induction, he starts off for beginners. But Thomas Merton says that he's writing for a certain kind of beginner. See that? He's writing for beginners. You're just a sincere person living your life. And something starts to happen to you. Something starts to happen. Where can you find someone to help you understand what's happening to you? And how to be faithful to it? That's the thing. John of the Cross says, there are many people to whom this grace is being given, but the actualization of the grace is not occurring because they don't know how to understand what's happening to them and how to be faithful. They're not receiving guidance in the subtle art form of the surrender. When John of the Cross talks about the dangers of the devil, he takes care of the devil kind of in passing. You know, be careful of the devil. When he talks about bad spiritual directors, he goes on and on. Because you'll get a director that's not aware of this. And the director will say, try harder, push harder. He says, maybe the time has come. He could stabilize your heart in something more, even simpler. It's not more complicated, it's more simple. And it's disarming and simple. And so these books are really like extended reflections of spiritual guidance for people to whom these graces are occurring and how to be faithful to them. So let's look at some of these texts together. Teresa of Avila. Teresa of Avila. Can't tell one mystic from another here. Here it is, right here. At the Imperial Castle. She says, just to get a flavor of these texts, because it's nice to hear how they talk. I mean, you probably read them. Most of you I know that with these. Here's how she puts it. She says that she talks about the soul as being a mansion, a castle. And in this castle, there are interior mansions, like rooms. And think of it as concentric circles going out, like a bullseye going out like this. So when you come into the first mansion of your soul, once you're in the first mansion, then you go into the second mansion, the third mansion, and so on like this. Each mansion consists of deepening states of consciousness of the nature of your soul. See, the nature of your soul is given by God, who creates your soul in imago Dei, in the image and likeness of God. This is who you are because God says so. And in the innermost center of your soul, God dwells. So, the soul, this is who you are because God says so. For Thomas Merton, this is your true self. But she said, there is who we are, and then there's the other question of the extent to which we realize who we are. We are who we are. We're the image of the infinite. That's what we are. We are that. But the extent to which we experience who we are is another matter. So the mansions of the soul refer to seven states of ever more interior consciousness, of ever deeper dimensions of the God-given, godly nature of our soul. Does that make sense in a way? And so she said, in the first mansion, this is where the beginner sincerely first starts to discover the interior life. This is where you discover interiority. And she says that the plight of the beginner has a lot of inner conflict in it. The way she puts it, when you found your way into the mansion, carelessly, a reptile snuck in with you. And these reptiles are running around inside your mansion, chasing you around in your prayer and so on. And these reptiles are habits of the mind and heart that are at odds with love. You might, God, how to get rid of all these reptiles that got in there with me. But the second mansion in is more interior. And in the second mansion, you realize the reptile didn't sink in that by because you were careless. You realize you're raising them as pets. That is, you're quietly nursing the compromises of your heart. You see that? See, you're afraid to surrender. It's like, dear God, please don't let me find what I'm looking for. Because I'm afraid to give up what I'm going to have to give up to go deeper with you. So I want to make you a deal. See, I think this is what happens. The ego is always trying to make a deal. Here's the deal. You say, dear Lord God, I really, really want this mystical union. Honest. I really do. I went on about all these books and got my candles burning. I'm really sincere. But here's the thing. Seriously, here's the thing. Under the condition that when I cross the finish line in the mystical union, my ego will remain intact. So that when I cross over, I'll be a mystical ego. And I'll finally get the respect I deserve. You walk out with people you live with and you can say, you know, I don't know if you're aware what a privilege it is to live with. And if you keep a closer eye on me, someday you may attain what I've attained. It's doubtful. But because I'm gracious, I have compassion on you. And then we're all just gruntled. We can't do that yet. Because we're trying to pull through the narrow gate, the ego, to be the receiver of it. That's not how it works. Thomas Merton once told me in Direction, I asked him what he thought heaven was like. He said, well, one thing for sure about heaven, there won't be much of you there. He said, that's why we'll all call it heaven. It's not crowded in heaven. No, I mean, there's no egos in heaven. You get two people in hell, it's crowded. Get one person in hell, it's crowded. You can't abide yourself. And so, she says, you begin to realize you're going to have to do more interior work in purifying your heart of what violates your heart. You get to the third mansion, and then you're praying like this. You get to the third mansion, and in the third mansion, you reach cruising altitude. You may feel free to move about the cabin. You kind of stabilize in virtue. You stabilize in awareness. You stabilize in patience. You look back and you see your life's a lot less chaotic than it used to be. You're grateful. The people around you are grateful. And it's real. There is psychological spiritual maturity. It is real. And at this point, she says, your prayer is the prayer of reflection. Sic ego. Your prayer is your lectio, your meditatio, your prayer, and so on. It's real. And she makes this statement. She says, the difficulty is reason has not yet been conquered by love. That's a great statement. The problem is reason has not yet been conquered by love. She said, people in the third mansion, they do go sailing, but they're always careful to keep the land in view. They're always careful to circle back and touch base to being with God on your terms, just to be sure everything's okay. The fourth mansion begins the prayer of quiet. Because you're praying this way, and here's how she puts it. As you pray, you're inclined not to move. He says, sisters, we need to know more than we think. And it's not that we need to know more than we think. We tend to think we know. But we need to know more than thinking can survive. You're not inclined to think of anything. You're not inclined to ask of anything. You're inclined to rest wordlessly in the presence of God. Beyond thought. Beyond things. Beyond things. This inner inclination not to think, but to subtly rest in the presence of God, is the beginning of contemplation. And as that habit deepens, the fecundity of it, I mean, the richness of it grows to a state of non-dual consciousness. And here's a text from the seventh mansion of non-dual consciousness for yourself. He's trying to describe what it's like to live this way. What this state of non-dual consciousness is, which he calls mystical marriage. It begins with spiritual betrothal. We might say that union, this is the seventh mansion, the interior castle, the seventh mansion, chapter 2, paragraph 4. We might say that union is as if the ends of two wax candles were joined. so that the light they give is one. The wick and the wax and the light are all one, that afterwards the one candle can be perfectly well separated from the other, and the candles become two again, or the wick may be withdrawn from the wax. You see that? So it kind of goes like this. It goes like this. You're sitting in prayer, but you're leaning into it like this. And it's like taking two flames. Here's God's candle, flames burning. Here's this little candle of your soul. And you can take two candles like this, and you merge them together, one flame. Pager goes off. Telephone rings, someone knocks at the door. Gotta take out the damn garbage, rush hour, and where'd all the unions go? And you come back to the berg and you settle in, candles get closer, and rest. See, then the daily activities that separates like that. In union, mystical marriage, in union, unit of consciousness. But here, that is here in the seventh mansion, it is like rain falling from the heavens into a river or a spring, and there is nothing but water there. And it is impossible to divide or separate the water belonging to the river which is from that which fell from the heavens. Oh, let me put it this way. There is union. And there is sadness. But you can no longer tell your sadness from God. There is clarity. And there is confusion. But you can no longer tell your confusion from God. There is wholeness. And there is brokenness. But you can no longer tell your brokenness. Your very brokenness is God. You're not trying to get past your brokenness. Here your very brokenness is God being manifested as your brokenness. Nothing to get beyond, nothing to get past, nothing to get around. No matter where you look, God in all directions. And yet you can't explain it to anybody. He says, at this state, your one question is, how can I be helpful? See, how can I be helpful? See, how can I be more present to the situation? In the divinity of the ordinary. This is here on that door. And let me make some statements on non-dual consciousness before we quote other mystics here. We'll stand and stretch, have a little dialogue, and take a break. How would that be? I'd like to make some statements of non-dual consciousness that help me to bear witness to it. These are some statements that help me to bear witness to it. To the ego, they're incomprehensible. They're kind of slippery. But in Alexio, you just receptive openness, they bear witness to a oneness. I'd like to make this series of statements. Here's the first statement. It is the realization that although I am not God, I am not other than God either. Although I am not you, I'm not other than you either. And although I am not the earth, I'm not other than the earth either. If that's it. Dan Walsh used to say at the monastery, in philosophy classes, he used to say, I know it, I know it, I know that I know it. It's like a conviction in your heart. But when I try to tell you what it is that I know, I don't know. It's crystal clear until you think about it. Something in the heart knows that it's true. Like in the left field of it. I am not God, for sure. In fact, without God, I'm absolutely nothing. But although I am not God, I'm not other than God either. I am not you. That's true. I'm Jim Tenney and you're not. As the Buddhists say, each of us breathes through our own nose. And yet we are not other than each other either. And we are not the earth, but we're not other than the earth. Next statement. lovers say to each other in moments of realized oneness, we are one. They realize in love that they are one. But in realizing they are one, they do not cease to be two. If they would cease to be two, they wouldn't be there to know that they're one. But they don't live by the two-ness, they live by the oneness. The oneness doesn't destroy the two-ness. It's the oneness that wholly permeates the two-ness and gives it meaning. Anyway, take that and extend it in all directions with everything and everyone, and you have disturbingly simple. Next statement. It is the realization, it's like the unexplainable realization, that that which utterly transcends me, which we call God, whatever you want to call it, it's beyond words really, Buddha nature, Tao, Allah, God. You're like Christ from the heart of it, there's no words for it. See, that which utterly transcends me is utterly giving itself away and emptying itself as the very reality of me, the very reality of others and all things. That which utterly transcends me, beyond, 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 beyond. That which utterly transcends me is utterly giving itself away and emptying itself as the reality of me. The reality of others. The reality of all things. Meister Eckhart has a great image for this. The word he uses is Gelassenheit. And you see the word, etymology of the word Lassen, lazy. Lassen. And in effect, Eckhart says, the Christian mystic Eckhart, he said, God is very laid back about being God. God's not uptight about it at all. God's so relaxed about being God. God gives being God away. As you. But apart from that infinite giving away of God, you're nothing. Absolutely nothing. Another image from Eckhart. And I'll paraphrase it. Imagine you're looking in a full-length mirror. And imagine the image of you is conscious, that it can think. It's a reflective thinking image of you. And the image of you that you're looking at tells you that it's been through a lot of therapy, it has read a lot of self-help books, and it has come to the point it no longer needs you. you say to the image, you try to be as gentle as possible with it. You say, you know, I think it's going to be a problem without me, since you're an image of me. The image says, no, I won't, I'm not backing off on this. I'm breaking out of here, and I don't need you. And so to demonstrate the situation to the image, you step halfway off the side of the mirror, and half the image disappears. The image has panic attacks, goes back into therapy. And goes back on damage. It says to the therapist, I'm not real. I'm not real. No, the image is real. It just isn't real in the way it's trying to be real. Namely, trying to be real without you. Therefore, it's not that we're not real. It's just that we're not real without God. Of whom we are the manifestation. We are the manifestations of the unmanifested mystery. Here's another statement I was saying. That God is the word that we use for the infinity of this. And this is the concrete immediacy of God. To intimately taste that as with the simplicity with which you know the palms of your own hands, it's disarmingly self-evident in some unexplainable way, is non-dual consciousness. That's non-dual. Non-dual means not two. I am not God, I am not you. But in this statement, there is a oneness that utterly precedes, utterly transcends, and utterly permeates the divisions and fragmentations of our lives. The divisions and fragmentations are still there, notice. But there's a oneness that utterly precedes, utterly transcends, and wholly permeates the divisions of the fragmentations. It's a unitive mystery that is at once all that God is and all that you really are. It is a unitive mystery. It is at one and the same time all that God is and all that you are. Now, in the Greek, they're recording this in case this is not crystal clear. You can go back and listen to it again. What we're going to do now, we're going to stand and stretch. We're going to sit, have a little dialogue, then we're going to take a break. Let's stand in silence. Let's stand and stretch in silence.